This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. I'm Rachel Mealy. This Tuesday, the RBA signals more interest rate cuts despite the risk of a property bubble, and the young women keeping Afghanistan's deep musical traditions alive.
For the girls, for Afghanistan, it's really important because to learn music, to tell the people that music is good.
First today to the crisis unfolding in northern Syria. As Turkey continues its invasion of the region for a sixth day, Syrian government forces are rapidly advancing from the south and taking control of towns once held by the Kurds. Now US Vice President Mike Pence is being sent to the Middle East, saying he's been asked to pursue a ceasefire as quickly as possible. And it comes as the United States slaps new sanctions on Turkey to pressure the country's president, as Thomas Ariti reports.
In the days since the Turkish invasion, images have been beamed around the world of injured civilians being carried into the region's hospitals. Women cry, holding their children, and the elderly receive medical care as thousands flee their homes and head to shelters and schools. And as the situation unfolds, the families of Australian women in the region continue to have grave fears for the safety of their loved ones. Kamal Debussy is the father of Mariam Debussy, who's in the Al-Hol refugee camp in the Syrian desert.
Action can still be taken, but I think that's a situation of days rather than weeks.
He's also revealed there are more Australians than he thought inside the camp.
There's a mother and a child. The child is quite seriously ill, and we're trying to get some more information about that mother and child overnight. We're also being made aware through the sporadic contacts that there is another mother and child that's had to be taken out of the camp. The child has become quite ill, between a life and death situation, and then been taken to a local hospital.
But according to the US Vice President, the volatile situation in northern Syria is not what Donald Trump wanted. Mike Pence spoke in Washington this morning.
The United States of America did not give a green light to Turkey to invade Syria. The president has been very clear on that point and reiterated that to President Erdogan today.
He says the United States wants to see a ceasefire without delay.
President Erdogan, I think, knows President Trump's mind on this matter, but President Trump pressed him very strongly in the telephone call today to immediately embrace a ceasefire.
President Trump has now instructed the vice president to lead a delegation to the region, and Mike Pence says a ceasefire is the priority, while pointing out that Donald Trump has always made his intentions clear to see an end to what he calls endless wars and to take US forces out of harm's way.
But that didn't mean that this president in any way encourages violence anywhere in the world, let alone along the border between Turkey and Syria.
Donald Trump has now revealed plans to authorize sanctions against current and former officials of Turkey's government and anyone contributing to Turkey's actions in northeast Syria. Steel tariffs will be pushed up to 50%, and the US will stop negotiations over a trade deal with Turkey that's worth $100 billion. Perhaps predictably, Republican Senator and Trump supporter Lindsey Graham has expressed his support on Fox News.
We're going to send a signal to Turkey that's unmistakable in the eyes of Erdogan and the world, and we're going to break his economy until he stops the bloodshed.
But for some watching the developments, it's too little too late. Nicholas Burns is a former Under-Secretary of State. He served in the George W. Bush administration. He's now a foreign policy advisor to Democrat presidential hopeful Joe Biden.
We had a policy that was working. American forces had been with the Syrian Kurds in northeast Syria for 5 years, and it was relatively quiet. The Syrian government, the Russians had been kept out, the Turks had been kept out, the Islamic State had been fought by a lot of us, and suddenly the president decided to bring our troops out, and now you have chaos. You have the Turkish army coming in, thousands of refugees, hundreds of people killed. The Islamic State looks like to be reawakening. This is a disaster for the president, and I think he's just trying to make the best of it here, but it's not very convincing to me.
There's no guarantee that targeting Turkey's economy will work. So although the US troops who'd been partnering with Kurdish fighters are leaving Syria, President Trump says they'll remain in the Middle East to monitor the situation. and, in the president's words, to prevent a repeat of 2014, when the neglected threat of ISIS raged across Syria and Iraq.
Thomas Ariti reporting. More than 100 flights have been cancelled out of Barcelona as hundreds of Catalan independence supporters have blockaded the airport, clashing with riot police. The demonstration was triggered when Spain's Supreme Court handed down lengthy jail terms to 9 separatist leaders over their role in the illegal Catalan independence referendum of 2017. Protesters are vowing to continue demonstrating until the sentences are overturned. Barbara Miller compiled this report.
The crowd was mainly young, large and angry. It converged on Barcelona's airport, bringing traffic to a standstill. Passengers abandoned taxis and attempted to make it to the terminal on foot, often in vain, with dozens of flights cancelled. Police sought to push back the crowd, firing gas and using batons. Dozens of people were injured. Demonstrations were also held in the city centre, 2 years after a referendum for full independence in the semi-autonomous northeastern region of Catalonia was declared illegal by the central government in Madrid, but went ahead anyway. After a trial lasting 4 months in which hundreds of witnesses were called, Spain's Supreme Court jailed 9 Catalan separatist leaders to between 9 and 13 years after they were found guilty of sedition.
Today's decision confirms the defeat of a movement that failed to gain internal support and international recognition.
Pedro Sánchez is the Spanish Prime Minister.
The government of Spain respects and abides by the decision of the Spanish Supreme Court, which puts an end to a judicial procedure meeting all requirements of due process, transparency and separation of powers. Nobody is above the law. Nobody is above the law. In a democracy like Spain, nobody is subject to trial for his or her ideas or politics, but rather for criminal conduct as provided by the law.
After the court ruling, a new arrest warrant was issued for the former Catalan president, Carlos Puigdemont, who fled the region in the midst of the referendum turmoil and now lives in exile in Brussels, from where he gave this reaction.
The Supreme Court ruling against the members of the government, the parliament and the most important social institutions in Catalonia confirms the strategy of repression and revenge against all the Catalan citizens who sought democratic ways to make their will possible.
There are some MEPs who support that view, with one Danish member tweeting that it was a shameful day for democracy in Europe. But the European Union has reiterated its backing for Spain's judicial process. Commission spokeswoman Mina Andriva.
This is and remains an internal matter for Spain, which has to be dealt with in line with its constitutional order. The European Commission fully respects the Spanish constitutional order, including the decisions of the Spanish judiciary. On the protests, I can only reiterate that, of course, the right to demonstrate peacefully and to express one's opinion is guaranteed throughout Europe.
Separatist leader Carlos Puigdemont has called on protesters to continue their opposition to the sentences.
I call on them to turn their indignation in the face of injustice into a positive energy that breaks down walls, that stops authoritarian regimes in their tracks.
And in London, they heeded that call, with several hundred people gathering outside the Spanish embassy. Among them, organiser Carlos Suarez.
They should be freed immediately. The prison should be open. And if the Catalan government does not do that, at least the Catalan people will protest. There's been today massive protest around Catalonia, and this will go on and on until a democratic solution is found.
The Spanish Prime Minister, Pedro Sánchez, says over the coming days the government will work to guarantee public order, responding, he says, proportionally to any violations of the law.
Barbara Miller. This is The World Today. You can find us on the ABC Listen app or subscribe to our podcasts. You can follow us on Facebook and on Twitter at ABC News. The Reserve Bank has signalled that further cuts to official interest rates remain a live option, despite the risk of refuelling a property bubble in Sydney and Melbourne. But that caution doesn't appear to be swaying the RBA, which is now pointing to another cut by mid-next year. Of course, the big question is how much any of future rate cuts will go to borrowers as the ACCC's mortgage pricing inquiry gets underway. The ABC senior business correspondent Peter Ryan is just back from the RBA's headquarters in Sydney's Martin Place, and he joins me now. Peter, do the minutes say anything about the ability of banks to pass on rate cuts in full to borrowers?
Well, Rachel, one of the big revelations from the October meeting was that the RBA board did have some discussion about the pros and cons of cutting the cash rate. And as you mentioned, one of the risks of fueling the property bubble in Sydney and Melbourne. But what's interesting, given the big focus on mortgage rates at the moment, is that the minutes make no mention at all of the ability of banks to pass on rate cuts in full. But the RBA board did signal that there would be a further cash rate cut perhaps by mid-2020. That's when the ACCC will be in the midst of its inquiry. But in the past, the Reserve Bank hasn't held back about whether banks should pass on rate cuts in full, though this time it's a complex matter given that investor-only borrowers got a full quarter of a percentage point, but residential borrowers only got about half, and banks have to look after depositors as well. And that's what the ACCC inquiry will be looking at, though. The major banks say there's nothing to see here. They say they'll be cooperating, but pretty much say that yet another inquiry isn't going to shed much light. But clearly the political pressure isn't going away, with the Prime Minister and Treasurer on the march, given the perception that some of the banks have been gouging their customers.
And you spoke there about that tricky balance for the RBA. They're either going to refuel the real estate bubble on one hand, or work out how low rates can go, given that they're already pretty close to zero.
Yeah, well, those minutes say that when the cash rate was cut to a record low of 0.75% a fortnight ago, the RBA board noted that the housing market and other asset prices might end up being overly inflated by lower interest rates. Now, the Reserve Bank board doesn't see the risk of another bubble outweighing the need to cut again, but says it will be cautiously monitoring the unintended consequences of lower rates in the economy. But they've said that that view could be reviewed if there were rapidly increasing asset prices accompanied by faster credit growth.
And the RBA is also worried about asset bubbles around the world. And given the amount of debt, what happens in the event of a global shock?
Well, when you consider in the wake of the global financial crisis, when there was a lot of quantitative easing or money printing, we now have record low rates. So a lot of governments and companies around the world have a lot of debt on their books. So if there is a global shock, or if interest rates start rising again, the Reserve Bank is saying that there is the potential risk of a global shock if companies or individuals even find themselves saddled with debt that they're having to pay more to service.
So, Peter, what's the betting for the next rate cut?
I just had a look before we came on air, and money markets are looking at a 41% chance of a cash rate cut to 0.5% in November on Melbourne Cup Day. That's when the Reserve Bank Board next meets. And if that cut does go ahead, there will, of course, be more scrutiny than ever on how much banks pass on to borrowers and also depositors.
The ABC's Peter Ryan, thank you. Queensland's new police commissioner is under growing pressure to fire a senior constable who leaked the personal details of a domestic violence victim to her former partner. Neil Punchard pleaded guilty to accessing confidential police databases and was handed a 2-month prison sentence, which was wholly suspended. He's been stood down from official duty since he was charged last year, but domestic violence advocates say he must be sacked. Stephanie Smale reports.
The woman, who can't be identified, says she was pregnant with her third child when Senior Constable Neil Punchard used the police database to help her former partner, his childhood friend, find where she was living.
It was like my threat had tripled. There was now an invisible enemy who was aiding and enabling a violent offender. But I just felt so unsafe. I had to relocate on 2 different occasions, and it made just me feel absolutely in shock. I now understand how so many women are dying from domestic violence in this country.
Senior Constable Punchard was stood down from official police duty in December 2018 after being charged with 9 counts of computer hacking. But the woman has called on Queensland's new police commissioner, Katerina Carroll, to fire him.
I'd like to call on the new police commissioner, Caterina, to immediately sack Neil Puncher, this officer, immediately, so that he's no longer a serving Queensland police officer.
Anti-violence advocates have described the two-month suspended sentence as grossly inadequate. Jennifer Boddy is a senior social work lecturer at Griffith University.
For this particular woman and for other victims of violence, they often experience severe trauma, fear, anxiety and so on. And we need to be looking at how as a community we can address domestic and family violence so these sorts of things don't occur.
She argues keeping an officer who has betrayed the community's trust in the police force is the wrong decision.
We need to be confident as community members that we are safe and that police officers will protect our privacy, and they have a duty of care to all of us to keep us safe. While a police officer retains his job in circumstances where they've put a community member at risk and violated their privacy, that sends a very concerning message to the community.
Jennifer Boddy points out Queensland's police commissioner needs to send a strong message that domestic violence is unacceptable.
I think irrespective of whether the police commissioner is a man or a woman, actions need to be taken to address what's occurred. All police commissioners need to have the concern for community safety as a priority and need to be addressing domestic and family violence.
In a statement, the Queensland Police Service says it's considering the judgment. The police service says it acknowledges the court's decision and Punchard remains stood down from official duty.
Stephanie Smale reporting. The number of Australians killed by accidental prescription opioid overdoses over the last decade has tripled, with physicians labelling the problem as a national epidemic. But as public health authorities struggle to curb the death rate, scientists say they've discovered a fungus here in Australia that could provide a safer and potentially less addictive alternative to traditional opioid-based painkillers. Rhett Burney explains.
More than 14,000 Australians have died from accidental overdoses since 2008, and prescription opioids continue to be the lead culprit. And as GPs and lawmakers work to tighten access to the highly addictive and deadly pain medications, the University of Sydney's Professor Mac Christie says those that are caught in the dangerous cycle of addiction are turning to drug dealers to get their fix.
We're seeing heroin come back. We've got designer opiates coming in from other countries in the world that are causing a huge rate of overdose death.
But Professor Christie and a team of scientists say they may have stumbled on a potential game changer, an Australian fungus that mimics opioids, providing the same pain relief as drugs like morphine, but without the dangerous side effects.
They still act like other opiates, like morphine and oxycodone, which we know cause immense problems with overdose. In fact, we have an overdose epidemic. But these new molecules appear to be safer in terms of producing less depression of respiration. So you're breathing depression and oxygen saturation in the blood doesn't go down as much when you get pain relief with these new molecules.
The fungus was found in muddy waters near a boat ramp in Tasmania's Huon Valley 16 years ago. When scientists placed it under the microscope, they knew they were onto a potential breakthrough.
What we found was that, and recognised early on, that it was had a similar molecular structure to our natural opiates in the body, the endorphins, but a completely different shape in parts of the molecule. So it was completely unusual, but somehow it looked a little bit like our endorphins.
Animal testing showed pain could be managed by the fungus-based formula in the same way opioids provide pain relief in humans. Professor Christie and his team are now working to find out if their finding could be less addictive.
There's the beginnings of evidence in animal studies that they don't produce as much addiction in animal models of addiction. Now, whether that translates to humans or not is another matter, but we would hope so and think so. But we need to actually control the use of opioids better, but we need these sort of new alternatives as well.
But only more testing will determine if that's the case. And while it's soon to get underway, it could be a decade before this potentially pain-killing and life-saving alternative is made available.
Rhett Burney with that report. Afghanistan has a long musical history that has survived turmoil and war. but it's one that was almost destroyed during the Taliban's rule. It was especially difficult for female musicians, given the extremists banned most types of activities for women. But now music is again flourishing within Afghanistan, and some of its best artists are women. An orchestra featuring the country's best schoolgirl musicians has been touring Australia. Fatima Alumi prepared this report.
It's rehearsal time for the girls of the Zora Orchestra as they prepare for a performance at the Sydney Opera House. The harbour city is a long way from home for these girls, aged 13 to 17, who hail from Kabul's prestigious Afghanistan National Institute of Music, the only music school in the country.
My name is Anita. I'm 16 years old. I play tambur.
Anita Alami is one of the girls in the orchestra. She and her peers have been training since their formation in 2015. The orchestra uses a combination of Western and Afghan instruments to create what is a unique sound. Many of these girls grew up amid war and poverty and were born just after the fundamentalist Taliban was thrown out of power. 14-year-old Mina Karimi plays both the cello and the Afghan string instrument Dilruba.
I was really happy to play in first female orchestra, and then it makes me really happy because in Afghanistan, playing music and being a female orchestra, it's really special and good.
Mina Karimi doesn't just play for herself. Her and her peers in the Zora Orchestra want to inspire real change.
Music is really important, not just for Afghanistan, it's important for all the world. Music helps all the people to be strong, to feel and to know music really. And for the girls, for Afghanistan, it's really important because a lot of years ago, music, like, might be if you didn't play music, we'll die there. So it's really important for us to play music, to learn music, to tell the people that music is good.
Since the rule of the Taliban ended, life has improved for Afghan women to an extent. But the path to becoming a musician isn't easy.
It's a little bit difficult, especially for girls. Girls face a lot of challenges in Afghanistan, but also we have people that support us.
Afghanistan's music scene is still rebuilding after being suppressed by the Taliban. Dr. Ahmed Samast has been at the vanguard of moves to rebuild it. He's the founder and director of the Afghanistan National Institute of Music, and he works closely with the Zora Orchestra.
The total ban of music, of course, left a very, very negative impact on the musical life of Afghanistan. It forced many, many musicians to leave Afghanistan, run away for their life to other countries. Practically, a generation has been brought up with no music.
And Dr. Samast says that more Afghan women are getting involved with music.
For me personally, music is not an entertainment. For me, music is a powerful force that can contribute to many aspects of life, including the healing of the people. In a country like Afghanistan, which has been for 40 years in war, the majority of the people of Afghanistan, in one or another way, they've been affected by war. There's a lot of traumatized people in Afghanistan, and the people of Afghanistan, more than anything else, they need to benefit from the healing power of music.
But right now, war and politics aren't on the minds of the Zora Orchestra girls. They're in Australia to play music, and musicians such as Mina Karimi want the world to know that Afghanistan is not just a land of anger and violence. It's also a place of wonder.
They will understand that Afghanistan also have beauty, Afghanistan also have music, Afghanistan also is a country.
Mina Karimi from the Afghan Zora Orchestra, Fatima Alumi with that report. And that's all from the World Today team for this Tuesday. Linda Mottram and the PM crew will be along this evening. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow with more stories from across Australia and around the world. I'm Rachel Mealy. Have a lovely afternoon.
Hi, I'm Stephen Stockwell.
And I'm Angela Wapierre, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal.
You've heard of boat people, but have you ever heard of plane people? 95,000 asylum seekers have arrived by plane over the last 5 years, and their lives are very different to the lives of those who arrive by boat.
Today's episode is all about the asylum seekers we don't talk about. Who they are, what happens to them, and why they keep coming.
That's The Signal, every weekday morning on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.